Hello, I'm Tim Sargent. This is number 0156, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0156. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet Donetta Held, who is the operator of the Crisis Cleaning Company. She's made a career cleaning up crime scenes. Did she ever think this is where her life would take her?
No, I mean, if somebody told me, because now people ask me what I do for a living, and I kind of joke and say I do death and meth, and they look at me kind of funny. But that's essentially, you know, what I do. And if you told me as a kid that's what I'd be doing when I grew up, I probably would have laughed at you.
Sarah Ehrlich, founder of Help for Orphans International, talks about taking your vacation to go and help others. How did she start on this path?
I was traveling with my husband. He has an art company, and we would go overseas buying antiquities from different places such as Uzbekistan, Peru, Cambodia, Vietnam, etc. And being in these countries, you see things that you do not see in the United States of America, and such as starving children. And after helping individual children, I just got involved with other groups and doing volunteer trips. And then I decided about 7 years ago to start my own organization.
We have another retro interview with a celebrity who is no longer with us. This time around, it's Bob Keeshan, better known as Captain Kangaroo. Later in life, adults who walked up to him would thank him for the hours of their childhood that they spent watching him.
For most, they were very happy experiences, happy days. And for many, I've had the expression that their childhood was not particularly nice, that they were neglected or perhaps even abused or worse. And their home was not as happy as it should be, and that I constituted something of an oasis for them, a father-child relationship that they didn't have in real life. And that's very poignant when people express themselves that way, but I'm happy that I was able to do some positive work of that sort.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0156, was Tim Sargent, a reporter at Global News here in Montreal, the other place that I work. And I thank you very, very much, Tim, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program. And the Stuff File Program is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the Stuff File news, shall we? Well, Fern Cooper, age 65, and 13 other cataract surgery patients arrived at Ontario's Oakville-Trafalgar Hospital on June 25th to learn that they would not receive the usual anesthesia because the hospital had decided to schedule an experimental day. And I'm doing air quotes. This experimental day was to evaluate how unsedated patients responded. Yeah. The Ontario Health Insurance Plan, by the way, had recently cut anesthesiologists' fees. Topical numbing gel plus doctor's reassurances were provided, but Cooper, who previously was diagnosed with severe anxiety, told the Toronto Star of the terror she felt when, fully awake, she watched the surgeon's scalpel approaching and then cutting her eyeball. Yeah. So the hospital is calling this an experimental day. You know, the doctors in Germany during World War II might have had a different term. By the way, so did the medical practitioners in the movie A Clockwork Orange. Experimental day. Okay. Rhesus monkeys have always been a problem. They pose a delicate problem in India, where they are both revered by Hindu law and despised for damaging property and roaming the streets begging for food. Now, in Delhi, the rhesus population has grown dramatically, aided by the Hindus who feed them, and street and private property are increasingly fouled as a result. However, Amar Singh's business is good. He owns 65 langurs, which are apes that are much more vicious than rhesus monkeys. And for the equivalent of about $200 per month, periodically brings one or two by a client's house to urinate in the yard so that the rhesus monkeys will steer clear. Now, you know, that's a successful business. Do you think he formulated a complete business plan, then went to his bank to pitch the idea for funding? Just how does one explain this business startup? I don't know, but kudos to him. Anyway, UK bureaucrats are consistently drawing criticism for their alleged overconcern with safety. In June, Royal Mail notified businesses on a street in Doncaster that it would no longer deliver to them on rainy days because the street was too slippery. One clumsy postman had just suffered a broken shoulder when he slipped and fell. And in May, the Somerset County Council ordered the removal of a yard sign advertising an upcoming public fundraiser on the ground that someone might bump into it at night. An event organizer pointed out that the particular yard sign was stuck in the grass directly in front of a tree, which was likely equally hard to see in the darkness. My, but we have become a soft society, at least in the UK, haven't we? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, maybe you've heard of the Lakeland, Florida pastor named Todd Bentley, who fancies himself a bit of a faith healer. The 36-year-old leader of Fresh Fire Ministries had plans to tour the UK this month, but suddenly several citizens are begging officials to ban him from the country. It seems they don't care for his often violent healing tactics. In one recent interview, Bentley claims that the Holy Spirit told him to kick an ill elderly woman in the face with his biker boot. So he did. He says, "Just as my boot made contact with her nose, she fell under the power of God." In another video segment, Bentley claims he cured a man of both cancer and a broken sternum by socking him in the chest. A British physician, Peter May, says, "I'm concerned by Todd Bentley's methods. I would urge people to keep away from him." Wow, it would take a physician to send that kind of statement out for you to not be near this guy? Yeah. Members of Parliament, or at least the Member of Parliament, Malcolm Wicks, even went as far as to request that Bentley be banned from the UK, saying his visit can do nothing but harm. The National Post reports that Bentley, who, by the way, is originally from Canada, is also a former Hells Angels member and recovering drug addict, and at the age of 15 was convicted of sexually assaulting a 7-year-old. In 2009, Bentley left his wife Shauna for Jessa Hasbrook, a church intern with whom he had an affair, according to the Western Standard. And in December 2011, Bentley told an audience that he had a hand in bringing 33 people back from the dead. He claims 20 of those cases were medically verified. Dude, are you available for parties? I mean, seriously, these are parlor tricks. Ugh, delusion. What is thy name? Apparently, that name for delusion is Todd Bentley. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Think about it. Somebody has to clean up after a crime. Ever wonder who does the dirty work? Likely a crisis cleaning expert like Donetta Held. Donetta operates the crisis cleaning company, and she joins us on the line right now from Indiana. Hi, Donetta.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So you get to clean up after crime scenes, and I understand one of the things that's becoming a trend are meth labs, correct?
Yes, that's becoming such a growing epidemic, especially to unsuspecting new home buyers or people that are renting property, not knowing what the previous occupant did in the property before they moved in.
What does it take to clean up a former meth lab?
Oh, we use, a very strong commercial cleaning product where we have to go in. Once we can't effectively decontaminate carpet and padding because it's very porous, so those items have to be thrown away. But we go in and we spray down the walls, the ceilings, and the subfloor and with our product. We let it dwell for an hour, and then we have to rinse it off. And that usually decontaminates all of the hazard of the from where they smoked it and cooked it, because a lot of people think that when they take the hazardous chemicals out that that's all that's there, but the residue from the smoking and cooking is very dangerous as well.
And depending on how large an area we're talking about, how long of a process is this?
An average house can take about anywhere from 3 to 4 days to do the whole process.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction that you cleaned up crime scenes. It's not just meth labs. It's other kind of crime scenes as well, correct?
Yes, death scenes, whether it's from a murder, suicide. Sometimes they're decomps from where, you know, somebody elderly had passed away. Nobody found them for a couple weeks.
How does someone actually get into this business?
Well, we were a family-owned business doing construction work and fire, water, mold remediation, and so that we were kind of doing nasty work. And when we were taking training, the classes, I had offered classes in death and crime scene. So I thought, well, we're already cleaning up from mold and all that kind of nasty water restoration work, so why not add death scene to it? And when we market to the sheriffs and the state police, and they started asking us about meth labs. That was becoming such a growing epidemic. They were asking for help in that area, so that I added that service to our company as well.
Is there ever, and this goes back to the meth question again, is there ever a danger for you or your crew in cleaning up a crime scene like this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You've got different types of dangers. If you're dealing with the death scenes, you've got bloodborne pathogens. So we have to wear respirators to protect the lungs and everything, because you have to treat every victim. You don't know what the situation was, whether they were HIV positive, whether they were full-blown AIDS, or they even had some other kind of disease that can be airborne. So we have to wear suits and respirators, the same way with the meth labs. We look like little blue Smurfs out there.
And once you've cleaned up a scene, how do you dispose what you've cleaned up with? I would assume there's a process involved there as well.
Yes, we have special boxes that we're supposed to put them in, and then we have to call a company that comes and picks them up, and they incinerate them, and actually burn them, and then they send us a certificate showing that it's been destroyed, and we're required by OSHA regulations to keep those certificates for like 30 years.
30 years?
30 years on a death scene, on meth labs, 5 years.
Wow. Now, yeah. When you're doing this job, you see this kind of thing being played on television as well. Television shows show people who clean up after death scenes and crime scenes. Do they get it right? Is there something they get wrong? The depiction we see on television, how accurate is it, if at all?
Well, for the most part, it's pretty accurate, but they're not really I think it would be a little more interesting if they show actually what goes on once those investigators come out and do their job and then they leave. I mean, I think it would be even more realistic for them to see actually what a company goes through, but it may be a little bit too gory for the audience.
Is there anything that you do as part of the cleanup crew? You're the last chain of command, I guess, within that particular crime scene. Is there ever a situation where you find evidence?
Absolutely. So, I mean, especially even on the meth labs, we're finding needles where they may have injected themselves with meth. We're finding some of those, and they smoke it as well, so we're finding some of those smoke pipes. They'll hide the stuff above the casing inside doors and closets. So we're all the time, because we're totally, when we're cleaning a house, we're doing it from every square inch. So we're finding every nook and cranny in the place. And we absolutely all the time are finding stuff that the police left over.
So then I guess it's your job to hand that over to investigators. I mean, are there things that you hand over and things that you just throw out, or does everything go to them and they decide what's evidence and what's not?
Yeah, generally, most of that stuff we hand it over to them, because if they have a case going against the person that might have been arrested for doing the meth there, then that's evidence they use against them in court. The property owner, particularly, if it's a rental property, may be suing the tenant for what they had did to the property.
And as you say, there's a danger to new owners or new tenants if they move into some place that's not been properly cleaned that may have been a meth lab. What exactly are those dangers?
There's been reports of people having respiratory problems, kidney ailments, headaches, or even unexplained rashes when they're dealing with homes that have contamination of meth. And you can't always—it's not something that's visible. It's it's something that you can't see and you can't always smell it, because we've had homes that we've tested them and they've been newly painted and somebody's moved into them and they've still, we've tested them and they're still highly contaminated with meth.
You mentioned OSHA a couple of times, and I would assume you have OSHA credentials, correct?
Yes,
What exactly does it take to get those? In other words, what separates you from an average company that comes in and cleans?
Well, you're required to, each employee that we have that sends out on the job is required to have 40 hours of OSHA HAZWOPR training, and then the supervisor on the job has to have additional 8-hour training as in a supervisor capacity, and we have to do refresher courses every year as well.
Is there a time frame after a crime has been, or after investigators are done, is there a time frame that you have? Do you have to be in and out by a certain period of time?
No. On a death scene, sometimes there's a situation where it's more of emergency, like family want to get in and they want to get like an insurance policy, or they want to get some special clothes for a burial or something like that. So they want us to get in and hurry up and get stuff done so they can get into the property. But beyond that, no.
Did you ever think when you started your business doing what you're doing, you said it's a family business, but did you ever think that this would be what you'd be doing today?
No, I mean, if somebody told me, because now people ask me what I do for a living, and I kind of joke and say I do death and meth, and they look at me kind of funny, but that's essentially, you know, what I do. And if you told me as a kid that's what I'd be doing when I grew up, I probably would have laughed at you.
Well, it certainly is a fascinating business. I understand you have a website. It's crisiscleaning.com, correct?
Yes, and we do make available a meth test kit that we try to encourage people before you buy, before you rent property. That's an affordable way to test the property to make sure you're not buying a nightmare that you don't want to deal with.
And people can find out more information by going to your website at crisiscleaning.com.
Yes.
Donetta, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us. It's been most enlightening.
Well, thank you for having me.
Donetta Held, who operates the Crisis Cleaning Company. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0156, and you'll find links to Donetta's site.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're experiencing the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax. Let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the founder of Help for Orphans International, and we'll have a retro interview with a celebrity that's no longer with us, this time around Bob Keeshan, better known as Captain Kangaroo. And of course, there is an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, but right now more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. A mother and son from Tamarack, Florida, will almost assuredly be placed on Santa's naughty list after being accused of stealing $2 million worth of toys. That's right, $2 million. The Broward County Sheriff's Organized Retail Crimes Unit arrested 46-year-old Ignatius Michael Polera and his mother, 70-year-old Margaret Polera. Sergeant Rich Rossman said the son's alleged crimes were especially egregious, noting he made it a goal of his to steal from all 50 states within 1 year. Well, it's nice to set goals, I guess. Which he was very proud of, and he did, by the way, accomplish. The Polaras allegedly used a system called box stuffing, where son and mother, along with an accomplice, would allegedly enter a store, grab a cheap item in a big box, empty the contents, and hide it in the store. They would then fill the box with smaller, more expensive items, seal it, and pay only the price for the original inexpensive item. Polera, with the help of his mother, would sell the stolen items on the internet and use the proceeds to finance trips around the world. He was actually supposed to go to Australia this week, but it was Michael's stupid greed which was his undoing. He used a reward credit card to pay for all his purchases because he still wanted to get his reward points, and that was his downfall. Investigators tracked the reward card's usage and discovered that since May 9th, Polera had visited 139 Toys R Us stores in 27 states, spending a total of $6,737.94 on 175 purchases. Yeah, that track record kind of follows you around, doesn't it? Ah, greed and a little bit of stupidity gets them every time. Anyway, in Kentucky, 46-year-old James Crittenden's nightmare started when he entered a Value Market in Mid-City Mall and began huffing cans of Ready Whip. This was an especially big problem because James had already gotten himself banned from the store for past disorderly conduct and theft. Nevertheless, he went through 10 cans of Ready Whip, with a total value of $23.90. He told store employees he'd pay for the cans, but then only had $7 in his pocket. Police were called, and by the time they got there, James was in the bathroom, where he allegedly lit the toilet seat on fire. Wow. The arrest report stated that James said he lit the fire for religious reasons. He also said he was huffing the cans to wake up, and that the U.S. Constitution allowed him the authority to huff Ready Whip. So now he's charged with theft, arson, and a bunch of other stuff. Okay, I don't use Ready Whip, but I hear it has a whole host of uses. However, this one probably didn't cross anyone's mind until now. How it crossed James's mind has to be one frightening journey. Okay, how many times have you said, "Ah, mother," because she said or did something to embarrass you or just didn't understand some sort of instruction that you left for her? Well, alleged drug dealer Jesus Pepe Fuentes, age 37, was arrested in Chicago in May after his mother botched a heroin pickup for him. Fuentes, who was eager to catch a concert by the rapper Scarface, sent his mother instead to gather the 10-kilo drop. She collected the drugs, but the entire shipment was lost when she failed to use a turn signal and was stopped by police. Now, there's some strong family values for you, huh? Anyway, sick and tired of drivers speeding in front of her home in Ningbo, China, 57-year-old Lin Chen decided to take matters into her own hands. She says, "There are a set of traffic lights near my house, and the cars just shoot through them as fast as they can. It's very dangerous." So Chen figured out a way to do what the traffic lights could not. She went out and bought one of those blow-up sex dolls, dressed it in a sexy red negligee, and then tied it to a tree in her front yard. Chen explained, "I thought the drivers would slow down if I could give them something worth looking at." She was right. And even police admit that accident figures have dropped. A police spokesperson said, "It isn't a method we would use, but we can't say it isn't working." You know, if this starts a trend, just think what the neighborhood will soon look like. And also, how do you explain this to the neighborhood kids? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, for 3 years, 6-year-old Isaac Lassen has been struggling with sinus issues and having difficulty sleeping, forced to do so with his mouth open. Well, those days are now behind him after doctors finally figured out what's been troubling the boy. Turns out, little Isaac had stuffed a small Lego steering wheel up his nose 3 years ago and forgot about it. His father later told reporters, "We think he bent the Lego piece in half, it's pretty flexible, and that it opened up once it got into his sinuses." Isaac also told doctors, "I put some spaghetti up there too, but that was a long time ago." I think this is a kid we have to watch more closely. And I also think I'm most concerned about this kid's short-term memory. I mean, how do you put a steering wheel from a Lego up your nose and forget about it? Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. How would you like to take a vacation that will actually make a difference? Sarah Ehrlich is the founder of Help for Orphans International, which is a secular non-for-profit organization dedicated to bettering the lives of orphaned children. And Sarah joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on with us. How often have you done these volunteer trips, and what got you into this in the first place?
Gosh, that's a good question. I have been traveling for about 13 years overseas, and I spend approximately 3 months out of the year overseas, and before I had kids, it was a bit more. But I was traveling with my husband. He has an art company, and we would go overseas buying antiquities from different places such as Uzbekistan, Peru, Cambodia, Vietnam, etc. And I've been to over, I think 100 and some odd countries. And being in these countries, you see things that you do not see in the United States of America, and such as starving children, street children, very young street children caring for their siblings. And I just got involved just, you know, helping individual children. And after helping individual children, I just got involved with other groups and doing volunteer trips. And then I decided about 7 years ago to start my own organization. So that's what I did. And we actually finally got our 501c3 status over 6 years ago now. And I was just pouring so much money into it myself. You know, the need is great. There's over 30 million orphans around the world. And just started helping by giving school supplies, building wells, putting in solar panels, things like that.
How many times have you done this over the years?
Gosh, I don't know. Too many to count.
Was there a situation when you first started traveling, was there something that particularly tugged at your heartstrings when you went abroad and you saw the situation and felt you had to do something?
Honestly, yes. It was probably about 13 years ago, and I was in India, and there was a little boy who's about the age of my middle child. He was about 7 years old, I'd say, and he was carrying a newborn baby. I mean, this baby truly could not have been more than 2 weeks old, and I was waiting in the car. It was super hot, and we went to many different art galleries and things. And so I was sitting this one out, and I was sitting in the back of the car, and this little boy came over, and he was saying in English, you know, eat, eat. And he's like, feed the baby, feed the baby. And he kept taking his hand and putting it up to the baby's mouth. But as he would say, feed the baby, he was coming up and hitting the baby's head on the car door and onto the window. And I was just, something happened to me at that very moment. I just felt like I went behind myself, and I was just looking at the situation. It was very unusual. And at that moment, I just decided something has to be done. And I know there are many organizations doing something, but it was just a pivotal moment for me. And I just decided this is what I want to do with my life.
Have you had any difficulties or issues in setting up this organization in dealing with some governments? Because, you know, it's one thing to want to help. It's another thing for countries to allow you to do so.
Right. Well, that's always the first step, is you have to handle your legal issues and get in good with the government, because some governments, I mean, for instance, we were working with a group in Vietnam, and they actually were saying that they thought that the group, they were spies. And, you know, certain things come up. So I've learned, luckily not the hard way. I haven't really ever gotten into any trouble. But normally we'll team up with local governments first, and then you have to get your status. I think America is the only place that they don't call it an NGO, a non-government organization, but in all the other countries, they're considered NGOs. So you have to get your NGO status.
So once somebody decides this is what they want to do, I mean, you've got this organization. I mentioned in the introduction that people can take vacations that actually make a difference. What can people do?
Absolutely. Well, I love to ask people to go when they land, they check into their hotel, and normally people go to the concierge and they ask for things to do anyway. Sometimes they might be set up, but regardless of what it is, I mean, if it's a ship, they could ask the concierge on the ship. Going to a decent hotel, they could ask the concierge at the hotel where a local orphanage is. And it's life-changing. I totally recommend that to anyone. And I always recommend when people go, you know, and a lot of people do this already, they bring their old T-shirts, you know, they just bring things they're not using. And that's like gold to these people. And sometimes you go to places where they have a lot of tourists, and all the kids will be wearing all these American old T-shirts, and it's kind of cute. But it's really helpful. They just don't have the simple things that we're used to. You know, they just don't have clothes. They don't have shoes. Shoes is a major thing. You know, bringing old shoes would be extremely helpful. We have another project going on. It's called Operation Backpack, and where we get people to put together backpacks so we could give these kids school supplies.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction the organization that you founded, Help for Orphans International. There is a website, which is helpfororphans.org. Can people go to the website and find ideas about what they can do once they decided they're going on a vacation someplace?
That may be on the website. I'm not actually positive. We just had our website updated with different things that we're doing. We're working with the U.S. Navy, so some of our things are called operations because that's the way the terms that they use. And like, for instance, Operation Perfect Day is something that we did with the U.S. Navy in Haiti, where it went and we raised money and got a bunch of things for the kids, and we just make a really nice day for them. But as far as things that they could do, yeah, there are different things up on the website, such as we have Operation Perfect Smile, where people donate dental supplies. We have dentists giving dental supplies that we give to the kids. There's also a shoebox project that we do every Christmas, and a lot of schools get involved in that, and they put together shoeboxes, and then we have them shipped to the orphanages so the kids have presents to open up. And it's really nice because normally the kids will put in a picture of themselves with a letter, and then we have pictures at the orphanage so the kids see, you know, the orphan getting this shoebox full of goodies, and it's just really nice.
Now, you're also the founder of another organization, and there's another website, which is called giveaflock.org. Tell us what that's about.
Well, Give a Flock is actually a campaign that we're running. It is under Help for Orphans, and it's just a new campaign that we're running. We have done many different animal husbandry programs, which includes just getting animals for different orphanages, so cows, so they have milk, chickens, so they have eggs, and then meat. And Give a Flock is very specific. It's we're working with chickens. And people could go to giveaflock.org, and they could get a T-shirt. The T-shirt costs $30. And with that, we go and we buy a flock of chickens, which is three chickens is what that is. It's a group of people don't know what the word flock means sometimes, unless they look it up. I guess they kind of know what it is, but it's a group of chickens that basically live and eat together. So we just thought it was a cute phrase, so give a flock. Obviously, it's a pun. And, yeah, so people get a T-shirt, and then we donate three chickens. And we've teamed up with, in Haiti, I just got back about 3 or 4 weeks ago from Haiti, and we were there, and I teamed up with a college professor who is working with us in four different orphanages, and he's teaching them poultry farming. And we're working with another group that they have 8,000 chickens, and they give them to single mothers who are pretty much on the street and at a very discounted price, and they sell the eggs. So that would be our ideal thing, to have something like that of our own. But currently we're working with four groups down there, and we're training the kids in poultry farming, and we've set up their own chicken coops. So all four places have their own chicken coop. We still need more chickens, so that's why people go and get a T-shirt at giveaflock.org. We could help get them more chickens. And when they get these chickens, it's such a great thing. It's a great gift, too, because people get a T-shirt so they could show, you know, what they bought. But then the orphanages will get three chickens, and those chickens will give approximately three eggs a day. One chicken gives approximately one egg a day. And it's hard to say the exact math, but it is normally they're popping out one egg a day. So three eggs for 17 months, that's how long that lasts. And at the end of 17 months, it just doesn't pay to continue feeding the chickens because they become light fowl. They don't produce enough eggs. They're not producing one egg a day after 17 months. So then they have the chicken for food. So it's really good. With enough chickens, it is completely sustainable. It helps the orphanage get food. You know, they raise extra money. Also, they could sell the excess eggs and pay for other supplies and things that they need. And also, with a good financial plan implemented, they make sure that they could buy more chickens at the end of the 17 months, and they just keep it going. So I found that this is just a fantastic program. And my husband's actually, he has a chicken plant in Arkansas. So that's what made me think, you know, about the whole sustainability factor. And I just looked at a lot of businesses and a lot of things, and it's like, how do you make these organizations sustainable? How do you give them something where it keeps giving and we don't have the problem on our shoulders continually? So this Give a Flock program is something new, and I'm really excited about it, and it's working out pretty well.
Well, it's some amazing work that you do. People can find out more information by going to a couple of websites, helpfororphans.org and also giveaflock.org. I thank you very much, Sarah, for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks for having me on again. Bye-bye.
Sarah Ehrlich, founder of Help for Orphans International. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0156, and you'll find links to Sarah's sites. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Is there a doctor shortage in America? Two recent reports paint two very different pictures depending on where you live. In New Jersey, the president of the State Medical Society says she's very concerned about a shortage of doctors there. Doctors tend not to stay in New Jersey, she said, in large part because of the high cost of liability insurance doctors must pay. Meanwhile, in Texas, the governor just announced that the number of doctors there has increased dramatically by more than 30% in 10 years. He says the addition of those doctors can be linked directly to a reduction in the cost of their liability insurance. Let's be fair, whether your family will face a doctor shortage depends a great deal on how much doctors pay for insurance where you live. Texas enacted common limits on lawsuits about 10 years ago that lowered doctors' insurance rates and helped attract nearly 12,000 new doctors. New Jersey has not enacted reform, and now they're worried about a doctor shortage. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
This is The Stuff File.
It's time for another retro interview with a celebrity that is no longer with us. This time around, it's a chat I had back in August of 1995. This was a television icon who I spent my most formative years staring at and learning from as a young child. His name was Robert James Keeshan, but to millions of baby boomer kids like me, he was simply Captain Kangaroo. I had a chance to talk with Bob about his television career and the state of children's television at the turn of the century. Here is part of that conversation now.
Let's talk a little bit about your years in TV. You spent a lot of time on television entertaining generations of kids. Did you think when you first started, and I guess a lot of people are aware of the fact that you were originally Claribel the Clown, correct?
Correct.
Were you aware when you first started, did you think when you first started that you'd have such longevity with children, entertaining children, and educating children all those years on television?
Well, I think if I had expressed that view, I don't think I thought very much about it, but if I had and I came to that conclusion and expressed that view, I'd probably be institutionalized at this particular point because it would not have been a very sane prediction to make. And really, when one is working every day, 5 and 6 days a week at on a television program and all the elements involved and all the people involved, you really don't start to think about what's happening next month or next year. You just simply are paying most of your attention to today and tomorrow and next week and next month.
Before we went on the air, when we set up the call, I have to admit to our audience, I gushed a little bit because I grew up watching Captain Kangaroo. Do you find when you go out in public, you come across 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, who even older, who still think of you as the captain and revert to their childhood when they meet you?
Well, I don't know whether they revert to their childhood, but what they are, of course, is a good deal more articulate than they were when they were experiencing the program. And they are able now to express, in retrospect, their views. They recall these experiences, and for most, they were very happy experiences, happy days. And for many, I've had the expression that their childhood was not particularly nice, that they were neglected or perhaps even abused or worse, and their home was not as happy as it should be, and that I constituted something of an oasis for them, a father-child relationship that they didn't have in real life. And it's very poignant when people express themselves that way, but I'm happy that I was able to do some positive work of that sort.
When the show first went on the air, it was the early days of television, and it was just a matter of putting things on TV to entertain the various age groups that were out there. Nowadays, when a television show goes on, there's so much thought process, I mean, even more thought process, there's focus groups and psychologists are involved. When you first started the Captain show, oh so many years ago, did you just do instinctively what you thought was good for children to watch on TV?
Well, I think in the very beginning it was very instinctive, and I think that's the key ingredient to any program that is successful. But of course, we all need help. I think people like Mr. Rogers is very instinctive. Bob Homey, the Friendly Giant, was very, very instinctive in the programming that he did. Mr. Dress-Up, very instinctive in the work that he did. But of course, we all do need help. And as time went on, we did avail ourselves of a lot of professional, child professionals, and whether they were educators or psychologists or what, they would give us, in a sense, a seminar on the needs of children. And so over a period of 35 or 40 years, those of us working together have actually probably assembled a body of knowledge and learned more about early childhood education than we could ever learn at university level, and any one of us could write a paper tomorrow, of course. And that's all very important. What is important, of course, is to be able to use it effectively. It is nice to have the knowledge of child needs, but it's also very important that we have the talents to entertain the child as well as to educate the child, and not have the child be aware of that line, the difference between the two. They should not be aware that they're being educated or served in some way. They should feel that they're being entertained, and we hope that the stuff of entertainment is the stuff that meets the needs of children.
I noticed you mentioned a couple of the Canadian television shows that were on for years and years. Were you aware of the Canadian content that was out there entertaining children?
Oh, absolutely. I'm very well aware. I talked to Mr. Dress-Up a month or so ago, and I know he's been just a staple for so many years, and I've always admired his work. And I think that you've been very fortunate in having some very talented people supplying good programming for children.
For all those people who grew up with your show and don't have to see on television anymore but may have kids of their own, are your shows available on video?
Yeah, we have shows that are available on home video. There are about six of them, and they're pretty good.
How many years was your show on the network on CBS?
On CBS, 30 years, and on public broadcasting for seven.
Was that difficult when CBS finally said, that's it?
Oh, no, that had been coming for a very long time. Certainly not anything sudden. There's this syndrome at networks that they've got to compete head-on with the same kind of programming that the other networks are programming at that particular time and that particular hour. And there's no common sense factor to it. It just it's insane. But, when the chairman at CBS Broadcasting said, "Do we want to be number one in the morning?" I said, "You are number one in the morning. You're serving families and children." And he said, no, I mean, I want to compete with the Today Show, and I want to compete with Good Morning America, and we're going to do it. Of course, that was 10 years ago, and they're still trying to catch up, and they still have not got the audience size that I had, if that's the game you want to play. But, it's very difficult to talk to show business executives. They're really a breed apart, and they don't have the same standards that the people, the families who are being served by television or not served by television. Those standards are quite different.
How do you feel about the television that's on for kids nowadays?
Well, I don't think that in the United States we've done anything that really we can be very proud of in the commercial sector, certainly. Our public broadcasting system does pretty well with Mr. Rogers and Sesame Street and Barney, that purple dinosaur that so many parents seem to be irritated by. But I often remind parents that the program was not made for them. It was made for children. And even though I, as a producer, I might add more to it and make it a little more complex a program, it still is a benign program with good values. In the commercial sector, we have some very, very significant problems. We allow broadcasters and advertisers to exploit children, which is not done really anywhere else in the world, because most societies believe that the children are their most precious asset and represent the future of their nation. So we in our early childhood programs outside of television, for example, in child care centers and in schools, we'll always say to children as early as 2 years of age, when you meet with controversy, use your words. Use your words to solve problems. And then we think nothing as parents of turning them over to the Power Rangers, who are the good guys, no question about that, who are saying use your fists, and use karate and violence and other ways to solve problems. And that message is not lost on 4-year-olds and 6-year-olds and 7-year-olds. And I think that the cumulative effect of programs like that, solving problems with violence, is showing up in our society in rather disturbing ways.
Is the problem, in your estimation, the fact that there is a show like the Power Rangers on and it becomes successful, or because it becomes successful, it's copied? In other words, if there was one Power Ranger and there was a Captain Kangaroo and there was a Sesame Street, would that be a more broad base?
Well, it might be, but there'll always be Power Rangers because the people who produce Power Rangers are not sitting down initially and saying, how may we nurture children? How may we help children? They're saying, how can we make a lot of money? And, whether it's Ninja Turtles or Power Rangers, and there'll be another one right following it, we're sure of that. We don't have the right attitude toward producing programming for children. And what really is important, but is the end user, if you will, is the parent. The parent who blithely says, well, I don't care what my kids are watching. Now, most parents would deny saying that, but whether they explicitly say, go watch television, and it's violence, or they implicitly say, I'm tired, go watch television, and not supervise the programming that children watch, the result is the same. It's a medium that seems to have escaped in the United States parental supervision. We would never think of sending our children out in the snow without the proper clothing, and we would never tell them go play in traffic, and we would never say here's your lunch, two candy bars and a bottle of soda pop. because we know as parents that children have to have the proper diet to grow strong bodies. Well, children have to have the proper diet to grow strong minds. We think nothing of ignoring television, and it is a parental responsibility. The reason the Power Rangers are successful is because there are millions of parents who are allowing their children to watch unthinkingly or thinkingly, and therefore it perpetuates itself. So it's a parental responsibility. No matter what government in the United States or anywhere else does to enforce standards, children are going to be watching inappropriate television. Most children in America, when they're watching inappropriate television, are watching adult television. You know, the talk shows and the Oprahs and the Donahues, and they're watching Grandma and working in the strip joint, and they're watching cross-dressers and all kinds of material that certainly we would think is inappropriate for children to view. But parents simply don't seem to intervene in that program selection process that's critical.
For parents who do want to intervene, however, I noticed you did an infomercial recently.
Yeah, we did an infomercial, and the people never really, I think they were underfinanced or something of the sort, and it never really has gotten out onto the market. But it was a wonderful device, and it's the sort of device that that the President of the United States spoke about, and the Majority Leader in the Senate, Senator Dole, spoke about just recently, the so-called Z-chip. It's very similar. The devices are very similar. It would allow parents to block out certain channels, and with the one that is now available that I did the infomercial on, it would allow parents to block the television altogether for certain hours. So a parent could say to a child, now, I'm not going to be home until 5:30 or a quarter to 6, but I know you'll be home at 3:15 or 3:30, and I don't want you sitting here watching television and eating potato chips and getting as fat as you can and watching programming that's not suitable for you. And the child will say, I won't, Mommy, but the flesh is weak, and they inevitably do. Well, one of these devices would permit the parent to simply block out the television in that period of time, so the child would presumably then do homework or play with other children. So in absentia, the parent would be represented by this device.
Sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, I think parents, you know, who are busy and who can't be there all the time, and, you know, that's a fact of life. We can't, you know, a lot of curmudgeons my age say, well, why doesn't Mommy get back in the kitchen and bake the chocolate chip cookies to meet the yellow school bus? Well, that's not going to happen because the two-paycheck family is very important on the continent these days, and we're going to see working parents of both genders, and we've got to accommodate to that, and they've got to accommodate to a different family style. And but that means that every technical device of this nature that is a tool for parents can be very useful in exercising parental authority.
Okay. Well, I noticed you use the term curmudgeon. That's not one I would use in referring to you, and I still think you're an inspiration because you're still busy, you're still active, you're writing books, you're still looking to do more television, and I think that's great.
Well, it's the only way to live a life. We have to keep active.
Well, Bob Keeshan, thank you for talking with us.
Well, I appreciate your conversation. Thank you so much.
That was part of an interview with Bob Keeshan, a.k.a. Captain Kangaroo. Keeshan died in Windsor, Vermont on January 23, 2004. He was 76. You can hear the full hour-long interview with Bob on my website at thestufffile.com. Click on Celebrity Audio Files and you'll find the interview with Bob and also interviews with others. They're all listed in alphabetical order and you can play them right off the page.
The Stuff File.
And we're almost done with this edition of the Stuff File program. We just have one more item to go, and that would be the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A naked and drunk Canadian inmate doing a cartoon impersonation dance unintentionally showed jail guards a plastic bag containing drugs hidden in his backside. The man had been arrested while cavorting on the street with a beer in one hand and a cheeseburger in the other. In Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, jail officials suspected the man had also ingested drugs, so he was ordered to undress in a cell for observation. The man reportedly asked guards if they were familiar with the animated character Cyril Sneer, which is an evil pink aardvark on the Canadian cartoon The Raccoons. Court heard he then tucked his genitals between his legs, bent over, and began dancing like the character moves. During his performance, guards noticed a piece of plastic protruding from his bottom. It was found to contain 4 doses of the powerful painkiller hydromorphine. Troy Campbell pleaded guilty to drug possession and was fined $805. Now, why would someone with drugs up their butt dance naked in a jail cell like a cartoon aardvark to amuse the guards? One reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0156. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0156. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, God. I always screw it up.